I'm Victor the Voice Furman, and you're listening to the DTM Wicked Radio Network. I'm Victor the Voice Furman.
And I'm Lori Sue Brockway, the Romance Reverend.
And we are Love and Romance Radio. Our guest this evening is Susan Shapiro. Susan is the New York Times best-selling author of 10 books, including the acclaimed memoirs Five Men Who Broke My Heart and Lighting Up. Her latest novel, What's Never Said, explores the topic of searching for old flames and the perils of revisiting past passion. She's an award-winning teacher at the New School who writes for the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, Cosmo, and Esquire. You can follow her on Twitter at SusanShapiroNet. Please welcome Susan Shapiro. Good evening, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful,
Hi, Susan.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that you're on the show. You and I have known each other for about 20 years or so, back from the old days of journalism when we all wrote on Selectrics.
Okay.
And walked our copy into the newsroom. You know, you're a great writer, and I've always been a big fan, and you've got a couple of books out that are just covering one of a topic that's so favorite to women, old flames. So let's talk about Five Men Who Broke My Heart, because during a life crisis, you began to go sort of reconciliation crazy, trying to connect with ex-lovers. What inspired
right.
it?
Well, like you said, I was having a midlife crisis, and truthfully, I had tried another book, a novel, about two sister-in-laws who switched lives, and I have a really close friend who tells me the truth, and I said, okay, tell me why it's not selling, and she said, okay, you have no imagination whatsoever. Stop writing fiction. Two sister-in-laws is the most boring subject in the world. Write about sex, and you're ambivalent about this person. You write best about people you love. So I went home crying and thought she was an idiot. And the next day I was reading High Fidelity by Nick Hornby, and there's a scene where the man goes back to re-meet his top five heartbreaks of all time. And I read it and I thought, oh, if a man does that, he checks out the woman. Is she still hot? Yeah, I'd still sleep with her. The end of the story. I thought, my God, if a woman did that, there would be 20,000 pages of diary entries and every therapy session she'd ever had and the gum wrapper from the first date. And it just so happened right around that time, I had an old boyfriend showed up at my doorstep, basically, and he used to make fun of my writing, a college boyfriend, and he shows up with his book, biology major. He shows up with a book. And he had dumped me unceremoniously years before, and I just was so enraged and weirded out and pissed off, but I completely suppressed it because I was really like, you know, I wanted to see this book. How the hell did he get a book? And I was a journalist, so I pretended that I was really interested in the book. I'm going to interview him about the book. But when he came by, what I found myself doing was interviewing him about what the hell ever happened between us and why did he leave me and what went on. And it bizarrely turned – I was going through a midlife crisis at the time, and I was turning 40, and I was going through infertility. And I don't know, I just – all of a sudden, all this emotion came out, and I asked him a billion questions. And what really shocked me was he answered them. And all of a sudden, from, you know, years later, maybe I don't know, maybe he needed my help with his book or something, but he was just really forthcoming and interesting and honest. And I was just like mind blown. And I have this really critical writing group, and I usually would bring in pages to the writing group, and they would say, you know, throw this away, it's throat clearing. And I brought in, I wrote up what happened with us in a personal essay, and I brought it in, and one of the women said, wow, you should have gotten old and bitter a long time ago, because this rocks. So I thought, oh, I'm onto something here. And I always say to my students, write about your obsessions. And I've always been obsessed with old boyfriends because I started dating at age 13. And I just was like, would date like a million people. Like my husband once said, I used to chew gum, and I'd chew a piece of gum, and then I'd spit it out, and then I'd chew five more pieces of gum. And he said, that's what I do with people. Like, and I just somehow would, I had all these crazy relationships when I was really young, before I was in therapy, and I never really understood what I was doing wrong because I didn't marry until 35. So I've always been obsessed with the subject. I wrote a poem once for Cosmo that started, if all your old lovers lived in a row of dark houses on the same street. So it's always been, it always bugged me that I had all these relationships starting, you know, at such a young age, I didn't know what happened. So right around this time after I met the first guy, I'm in Michigan visiting my family, and another college boyfriend calls and says, let's have lunch. So I said, okay. So a similar thing happened. So I thought, okay, you know, I thought of the five top heartbreak of all time, you know, with Nick Hornby. And I thought, you know what, I only have three left because I wrote a list of five, you know, and a couple of them were really easy to find. So I thought, let me try this. And I tried it, and it just somehow worked. And I had been trying to get an agent and work on book projects for a long time, and this one just took off.
That's
so
amazing.
That was how it started. Yeah, so it kind of fell into my lap. And then, you know, Nick Hornby did the male fictional version, so I tried the, you know, the nonfiction, the memoir. And, you know, what was great about it was that I did find it was very universal. In fact, I think, you know, when we wrote the copy, it was for, you know, we wrote for Five Men Who Broke My Heart. When we were publicizing the book, we wrote, for anyone who's ever wondered what happened to their first love, or second, or third, or fourth, or fifth.
That's great. It is universal, for sure.
That is wonderful. Now, you begin the book by saying names, dates, and identifying characteristics of many of the people portrayed in this book have been obscured for literary cohesion to protect privacy and so that your husband would not divorce you. So
right.
What did your husband think about you writing about old loves? Did he actually encourage you?
No, he hated it. But what was going on, he absolutely hated it, but let me tell you what was going on. What was going on was that he was having this really cool career. He's a TV film writer, and he, at one point, was getting sent to, like, Asia for a month, and he was doing all these anime projects and stuff. And so I'm having a really rough time with work. I have been trying to sell a book for years. And also, I teach, so I had all these students that were getting book deals. I was helping them get book deals. So I'm like, here, the wedding planner who can't get married here. And then we're going through infertility, and he's taking off for 6 weeks to go to Asia. So at one point, which, you know, which doesn't really help with infertility so much. So at one point when he was walking out the door, he said to me, by the way, you can't write about me, you can't write about our marriage, and you can't write about our infertility. See you later. And takes off for 6 weeks. So, you know, I thought about it for a long time, and truthfully, I was never the type girl that, like, I always want to get married. You know, that wasn't my dream. My dream was to do a book. In my head, any idiot could get married. You just need another idiot. But a book was like, oh, my God, that was, like, my dream. And something was, you know, there was something really brewing that was very exciting. So I just wrote whatever the hell I wanted to write, which was, you know, saw the old boyfriends, wrote it up, got a fantastic literary agent, got a fantastic book editor. You know, and I really thought about it, and I thought, when I got married, I was very scared and ambivalent, and I thought to myself that the way that I got myself married was I said, I would rather my obit say I was divorced than never to have been married at all. So I thought, you know, so I thought, okay, I gave it a shot, you know, and if it doesn't work out and I get a book, I could handle that. So anyway, he came home and I showed him the manuscript and I said, I got an agent, I got an editor. So if you can't handle it, I understand. Let me know. So he read it and he came out and he said, there's some things you have to change. And I said, okay. And he's like, you're never allowed to use my real name because, you know, he has his own career and people don't really, his people didn't necessarily know my name at that point. And I said, okay. And then he's in TV film. So he said, you can't use my age because of age discrimination. I said, okay. And then he said, go for it. And I did. And I'll tell you what the most interesting thing for me was that in the book, the best advice that I mentioned that my shrink told me a long time ago was, love doesn't make you happy. Make yourself happy, and then you'll get love.
Amen.
So
Amen.
That advice was in the book. And then what was so fascinating was what I later realized was, number one, that when I re-met all these men and I had blamed them for everything, that I was the one who screwed up each relationship myself because of that very thing. Because every single time I was in a relationship when I was younger, I had this huge expectation that the man was going to make me happy or fulfill me. And I would look to the relationship for way too much. And then, of course, it would disappoint me. And then I would blame the guy. But what was really fascinating was, you know, I'd been really miserable with the infertility, and I'd been frustrated with my husband, and he was going away, and I was waiting for him to come back. And what was so interesting was in writing the book, my life got so exciting. I got exciting because here I'm rocking this exciting project that took 6 months and a big editor, a big agent. I'm on the Today Show. I'm selling film rights. I'm selling TV rights. Everything is happening. And it changed the whole dynamic of my marriage because instead of waiting home for my husband, he'd come home and I'd be like doing an event for 500 people. And I would like, you know, call him and say, oh, by the way, I'll be home at 2. And I was just so, and I was traveling and I was so busy that he had to chase me and I wasn't sitting around waiting for him. And my life got so exciting. And it actually made the marriage more exciting. And so weirdly, inadvertently, by writing the book, I wound up taking my shrink's exact advice, which was love didn't make me happy. I made myself happy. And then all of a sudden, I'm having this amazing career and running around and making money and teaching and everything's great. All of a sudden, I look and I'm like, hey, I have a cute husband, too. This is really cool. You know, so it wasn't, instead of focusing my entire world from the minute I wake up and where is my husband, where is my baby, where is my marriage, take me to Paris. It was like, you know, it was. I put my own life and my own career in the foreground. And of course, you're much more exciting and attractive to anybody when you do that.
And
so it was a very healing process, the book.
And for all of our listeners, male and female, who are single, who are going for that, through the expectation of looking for someone to make you happy, take Susan's advice. It's the best advice that anyone can give.
Be your own soulmate.
Yep.
I'll tell you a funny story involving my husband and the project, which is, so he's this brilliant TV film writer, and he's written for like Seinfeld and Saturday Night Live and In Living Color and Law and Order. So I'm living with this brilliant, genius TV film writer, and they keep, Paramount bought it and Lifetime TV bought it. Everybody's buying it. They keep trying to come up with versions of the screenplay, and nobody can get a good version of the screenplay. So finally I decide that I want to write it, but here I am with the most brilliant TV film writer and critic in my house who hates it and won't help me with it. So finally, I just begged him, and I just said, you know, you have to help me with it. So he said, okay, let me tell you what the problem is. The problem is that when you went back to re-meet your top five heartbreaks of all time, you didn't touch them, you didn't kiss them, you didn't screw anybody, you just had lunch or dinner and conversation. So he's like, that is the least dramatic in terms of just a dramatic story. Nothing happens. It's like therapy, you know. It's like nobody wants to read about someone having lunch with the ex-boyfriend and waving bye-bye and then going home and writing about it. So boring. You got it. You know, we're doing this. He said, you do the screenplay, screw one of them. So I'm like, no, I don't want to, like, I don't want to be like the person. Everyone knows it's a memoir. It's not a novel. I don't want to be, you know, so here my husband is telling me I have to screw one of the guys fictionally in order to get the screenplay to work. And I didn't believe him. And I kept trying to rewrite it. And I'd give him notes. You know, I'd give him the screenplay and then he'd write notes on it. And it was so hilarious because he hated, it was almost a sitcom trying to write the screenplay to the story that he hated. But so I give it to him, and then on the side there'd be these notes that are like, you know, she is a total cunt. And I don't know whether he's talking to me or the character, or he's like getting rid of the rage, or he's just trying to help me, but it was just not happening. So finally, Lifetime TV hires this writer who is like the perfect person. She's like younger than me, but she's Jewish, and her dad's a doctor too, and she's from the Midwest, and she just got married, and she's like the perfect person. And I'm thinking, he doesn't know what he's talking about. She's going to nail this, you know, without having to, you know, ruin the character and have her be, you know, screw around idiot or something. So she tries like 7 drafts, and it doesn't happen. They finally drop the project. What's her next project that she wins Emmys for? The Affair. where they destroyed two marriages over an affair because they both screw around. So it was so it was kind of hilarious. So it was like, you know, but you know what? I thought about it and I thought I would rather have not screwed around and still have the marriage than had the movie made, you know,
right.
At that point. I had decided I liked my husband at that point. So I thought, you know what? It's not really worth it to change it. But anyway.
What do you think, these are really hilarious stories, what do you think is the draw about finding former flames? I don't hear men talking about it so much, and I agree with you that sometimes, you know, they want to see a picture first, or they want to really see what the person looks like before lunch. But women have such a deeper emotional attachment to these old flames. When you think about them, sometimes it's almost as if it happened yesterday.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the life I could have lived. You know, and I think, you know, you hit middle age, or, you know, you hit 40, you hit 50, and all of a sudden, what's that great line? There's a great line by Oscar Wilde, which is, there's two tragedies of life. One is not getting what you want, and the other is getting it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think even if you fall in love and you have kids and you get married, I think at a certain point at age, you know, 40 or 50, as you get older, or kids are grown, or whatever's going on, I think that it's really common to feel disappointment, you know, and especially, you know, I'm in New York. My husband was in LA for a long time. And so just your expectations are so exciting. And at a certain point in your career or at the beginning of a love affair, everything is just so wildly exciting. you know, and amazing. And then as you get older, it's hard to sustain that. And so I think people sort of, you know, grasp at things from their past and think, why isn't my life exciting? If I would have done this, mm-hmm. it would have been. And my second memoir was Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex. And that was this fantastic addiction specialist who helped me quit everything. I quit just like deprivation overload. I just quit drugs and alcohol and cigarettes and stuff. And at one point, I remember we had a session and I had quit everything and I was dieting, no bread, no diet soda, just quit everything in the world. And at one point I started telling him, oh, I went shopping and I bought this and I bought that. He's like, how much money did you spend this week? And it turned out without even realizing it, I had spent like $4,000 in a week on things I just didn't even need, which was the most I'd ever spent in my life. And I'm like, oh my God, what's happening? And he's like, now you're addicted to shopping. And he said, beware all excitement because it takes you out of yourself and you always have to go back to yourself.
Mm.
And so I did, you know, so I'm in my own weird way, I'm kind of an excitement junkie. You know, I mean, other people might not find it exciting, but like getting a book deal or being on TV or getting in the New York Times, it's such, there's so much adrenaline. But what I found as I get older is it's hard to sustain. And even if you're in a relationship with someone you know, that you love, it's, you're never going to feel like you did at 16 going to the prom, you know, or on your wedding day. You know, you're just never going to be able to sustain that amount of joy and passion because it was new and fresh and exciting. And so I think people are constantly thinking, what's wrong? I want to go back to feeling that passion or that joy or that excitement, and they can't. But so I think the illusion is, oh, if I would have been with that guy, or this is how I felt at 16, so I could feel this again. So I think that's part of it. And I actually think men do it too. In fact, one of the most, you know, in my writing classes, the first assignment I give my students is write about your most humiliating secret. And so many of them, men, women, gay, straight, trans, a lot of them start with looking up somebody on Facebook, looking up somebody on Instagram, somebody follows you on Twitter. And, you know, and so that's the beginning of so many of them. And sometimes it's, you know, it's a mother, father, child, sibling, but 90% of the time it's an old lover. And they're really fascinating stories. I mean, one of them is this one woman wrote about how the man she went to prom with contacted her, but she didn't recognize the name because now he's a woman. Like, there's really great weird stories,
yeah.
You know, or somebody who's now in jail,
yeah.
You know, or, oh, this is a really scary one. Someone wrote, Facebook suggested I befriend my rapist.
Oh, my God.
No.
Yeah, and it was someone who'd been gang raped when she was a kid, and then she was friends with someone from her old town, and they suggested the whole group, and she confronted them on Facebook. But anyway, so I feel like it's a very – I think that social media has made your past more you know, it's more possible to find somebody quickly. So I think in the past maybe – people wondered what happened or had these sort of little illusions or fantasies, but then you'd have to write a real letter or make a phone call. And now I think with one click of the button, you can pretty much find anybody in the world. So I think that kind of facilitates a little bit more, you know, it sort of adds a concrete, obsessional, active quality to what I think in the past was just sort of a mild obsession.
Yeah, yeah. Now, before you met your husband, you mentioned you plunged in 5 times heart first, and you termed yourself a serial monogamous love junkie. How did you go from being that to letting that go and being married?
Well, I was 35, so, you know, I had been dating since I was 13. And, you know, so it was a lot of that's a lot of breakups. And I didn't have, like, regular breakups. I had, like, spectacularly amazing public hideous breakups. You know, like, so my college boyfriend, when we broke up, didn't sleep with one of my roommates. He slept with two of them, you know, after 6 years and an abortion. You know, it was just like, so they were so spectacular that I was, what's that line from the Robert Lowell poem? I'm tired, everybody's tired of my turmoil.
Yeah.
You know, because it was really like, you know, it was so extreme. Because picture, it's, you know, okay, so it's, you know, I'm age 13 to 20, and then that's this horrible, disruptive, insane thing that everybody knows about, and then I wind up in New York. It was like one after the other. So part of me, I was tired, you know, part of me was like, you can't do this anymore. And so so that was a little bit of it. Also, I think that, and I write about it in 5 Men Who Broke My Heart, I also think that I was trying to find I had this expectation that I'd find my soulmate too young. And I think it's the poet Rilke in Letters to a Young Poet says, there's certain creative souls that should not connect with somebody else ultimately until they're 35. And it's interesting because I got married at 35, and I think that's really good advice, because I think that there's a certain type of personality that just keeps changing and evolving, and you don't know who you are until then. Mm-hmm. So every time I would, you know, I'd meet someone. So I met someone at 13, and then I met someone at 20, and then I met someone at 23, but I didn't know who I was yet. And, you know, and so I was still forming that. I remember one of the men in Five Men Who Broke My Heart, I was talking to my shrink about it, and I couldn't figure out why I was so obsessed with this person, because he turned out to be a sociopath, and I had been with him for a year and a half, and I didn't even see it. And she was like, well, why did you fall for him? And I said, you know, he was this great writer, and he had a book deal, and he had this amazing village apartment, and he had thousands of books all over the place. And as I was describing it, she said, oh, you didn't want to marry him. You wanted to be him.
That was the biographer?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so what had happened, I think, was that I was so dazzled by the life he was living, and I wanted to be in that life, and I sort of mistook that maybe for I want to be married to this person. Mm. I really want it. You know, I was fascinated, and I didn't know why. But anyway, so I think that by the time I was 35, you know, by the time I had met the man who became my husband, I was older. I had actually two great careers I liked, because I was writing by day and teaching by night at the New School, which I loved, and at NYU. And I sort of my life was sort of formed. And also he was spectacular, you know, so in a weird way, you know, one of the things I realized with Five Men Who Broke My Heart was that I was meant to wait because, you know, I just met somebody who was so perfect for me in so many ways when I was 35, although interestingly, I came close to screwing that one up too. So the book really helped me because I was doing the same pattern, which I think a lot of women do. And by the way, I fix up a lot of marriages. I fixed up over 30 marriages, and I have a book about it called Secrets of a Fix-Up Fanatic. And it's amazingly common. In fact, what shocks me is that I meet women of all ages, whether they're 20, whether they're 50, whether they're 70 and widowed and divorced. And I feel like they still do the same thing. Men do it to a smaller degree, but women do it to a huge degree, which is there's this unrealistic expectation that a relationship is going to come sweep you off your feet and take away all your problems and make you happy. And it just doesn't. So it sort of astounds me that, you know, so I didn't, at 35, I still had very unrealistic expectations. And I always say, my husband hates when I say this, but I always say I fell madly in love with him on our fifth anniversary. And that was partly because I sold the book, you know, so it was, so I really had my own exciting career going. And the other thing was right around then is when I quit smoking and drinking. And I didn't realize that I had a lot of substance problems that were actually getting in the way of my ability to have intimacy. So I was blaming things on all these poor men that I had dated, but the truth was that, you know, I was throwing off all these unrealistic expectations on them, and then I had all these substance problems, and my addiction specialist said, addicts depend on substances, not people. So I was not, so when I was smoking and drinking and toking, there really wasn't room for somebody else to get close, because whenever I had any emotion I couldn't deal with, I would grab a cigarette or a joint or food or alcohol. And so there wasn't even room for a real person in my life until I got myself together.
That's really powerful, because, you know, it sounds like a lot of the work you've done in completing with your past has really brought you into a very powerful, you know, current relationship with somebody. Sometimes we get lost in all those old loves and what they might have been. Do you think it's a good thing to go back in time and connect with people and see?
You know, it's funny because my the first book, Five Men Who Broke My Heart, when I you know, re-met all the five men, I was turning 40, and it was a comedy, and it was everything about it was wonderful. I mean, there was only one guy who didn't want to meet with me, and my first boyfriend,
the one
that I went out with for 6 years, yeah. And I remember when I asked him if he'd like to get together to talk about what happened between us in the past, he said, I would rather take out my own appendix with a bottle of Jack and a dull spoon.
I was going to ask you if that was true. He said he was
not only was it true, he refused to meet with me, and I freaked out because I thought, oh, my God, he was my first love, and if he won't talk to me, I have no book. But he agreed finally to just email back and forth and answer some questions, and he was so nasty, and I brought it into my writing group, like, crying, thinking this won't work, and they're like, oh, my God, this one is the best one because all the others are so friendly and nice, and it's so much more realistic that if you knock on someone's door after 20 years, they'll be nasty and not want to talk to you. So weirdly, it worked for the book to just have the email exchange with the one that wouldn't meet with me, that it made the book sort of more realistic. And then, interestingly, I finally did get to meet him. He did finally, 25 years after we split up, he finally came to New York and we did have a tete-a-tete, and I wrote a New York Times Modern Love about it. Anyway, so everything about that book just felt like a dream. In fact, I always say to my students that writing is a way to turn your worst experiences into the most beautiful. And that's what I felt I did, because I had these hideous breakups and all of a sudden I had this hardcover book and, it did well. And then I got this other book lighting up. So I was so excited and everything was very positive. Okay, so cut to right when I'm turning 50, I re-meet another man, and I always, the way that I call this new novel What's Never Said, and the way that we talked about it was, you know, in 5 Men Who Broke My Heart, I went back to re-meet my top five heartbreak of all time, but there was one story I never told until now. And in that story, in real life, maybe he didn't break my heart, maybe I broke his. But anyway, so in real life, I re-met this person, and he didn't know who I was.
This
I went up to say hi to him.
Former professor? You went
yes,
to the book
yes,
signing with his?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and he didn't know who I was. And I freaked out, and I thought, oh, my God, have I changed that much? And it got really, really, really dark, you know, about did I misremember it? Does he have Alzheimer's? Do I have a complete misconception of myself? So I flipped out, and I started writing about it. And, again, the writing group was like, wow, this is so creepy and weird and twisted. You must keep writing about it. But so, and interestingly, so that was the dark side of what happens when you go to re-meet an ex. And the worst part that could happen, because it threw me back into everything that had happened between us and whatever. And then I wound up writing that one as a novel called What's Never Said. But it's interesting. So at 40, maybe when I was just, you know, pretty newly married and, you know, for some reason it all seemed funny. But at 50, re-meeting someone, maybe it wasn't so funny anymore. You know, so I do. So it is interesting that you have the 5 minutes, the hilarious, happy side. And What's Never Said is really the dark, twisted side. What was interesting with What's Never Said was I was at a party with my husband, and I told my husband later, I was sort of crying, and I said, you know, God, this weird thing happened. You know, he didn't even know who I was. And he said, oh, the short guy in the blazer? And I'm like, yeah. He said, he was glaring at me and you all night. I was wondering who that idiot was. He knew exactly who you were. And so then it got even more interesting, because what do you have to do to someone if you're at a party and 30 years later, right after you've won a Pulitzer Prize, you pretend that you don't know who they are? So that got even more dark and twisted and interesting, right? Because that's even, you know, that's way more interesting than if someone's just like, hi, how are you? Nice to see you. Here are pictures of my kids. You know, but anyway, so that led to What's Never Said, but that was a darker story. So, and interestingly, I just did an event with a shrink friend when I was in Florida, and the whole idea was, should you re-meet your exes? Should you re-meet your old flames? And I think there are times when it's brilliant and fantastic, and then there's times when it would be a nightmare. So I think you have to, you know, you have to be really, really clear on what your expectations are. And, you know, and by the way, when I fix up people, and again, I fixed up 30 marriages. One of the first things I asked them to tell me is, tell me about your history and what was the closest, greatest relationship you ever had. And sometimes I definitely think, especially if it was high school, college, graduate school, sometimes I do say to the person, can we find out if your ex is still single? And in one case, a woman who was in her 50s reconnected with the fiance that she'd broken up with in graduate school, and she married him.
Wow.
She wound up, she wrote him a letter. I suggested a letter, you know, not an email, a letter, just saying, really not, you know, not being too heavy, but just saying, I just want you to know, I still think about you. You were the best man I ever met. I just hope everything's great in your life. I just wanted to say hi. And it turns out he was going through a bad divorce, and they reconnected and got married. So I do think if you're single and there's, you know, the one that got away, or, you know, there's somebody that you weren't, another great reason is in AA, you make amends. So if there was someone in your life early on who you weren't nice to, which is a really common thing for women, you know, when you're 13 or 17 or 20, you know, everything's a whirlwind. And maybe there was a nice, boring, nerdy guy that you didn't treat well and you always regretted it. So I think, you know, it's always, I don't think it's ever a bad idea to write someone a letter and say, I'm sorry, I wasn't nice to you, or I always think of you so highly. So I think, you know, and especially if you're single, I don't think it's horrible if you're single to do that and find out if they happen to be available, because as you get older, many people, 50%, you know, about 50% get divorced, and a lot of people are widowed. Some people are still single. So I think that, you know, that isn't a bad reason, although you have to watch your expectations.
Our guest is Susan Shapiro. She's the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books, including her latest novel, What's Never Said. Susan, please tell our listeners how they can find out about you and more of your books.
My website is susanshapiro.net, and you could follow me on Twitter at susanshapironet. I'm very easy to find.
Wonderful. And we'll be back with Susan on Love and Romance Radio on the DTM Wicked Radio Network after these messages.
The Karen Coaching Center is a proud sponsor of DTM Wicked Radio Network. What would it mean to you to have better health, more energy, more vitality, and an all-around better life? At the Karen Coaching Center, our mission is to be your partner in helping you reach your health, fitness, and lifestyle goals. We do this through a dynamic 6-month program that helps our clients reach their goals and their full potential. And it all starts with a free, no obligation, 50-minute health history consultation. Just visit us at the www.thecaringcoachingcenter.com to schedule your free consultation today. Or you can go to www.dtmwickedradio.com, click the sponsor page, scroll down to the Caring Coaching Center tab, click on the tab and open up to the website to start your free consultation today. It's all here on dtmwickedradio.com.
Rolling Hills Asylum. Located in East Bethany, New York, just minutes between two major airports, Rolling Hills Asylum is a hotbed of paranormal activity. They have been featured on Travel Channel's Ghost Adventures, Paranormal Challenge, as well as Sci-Fi Channel's Ghost Hunters. Rolling Hills Asylum has been named the number 2 most haunted location in the United States by HauntedNorthAmerica.com. The property was established on January 1st, 1827, as the county poor farm. Throughout the years, it has operated as a poor farm, infirmary, orphanage, tuberculosis hospital, nursing home, and more. Past residents and inmates consist of widows, orphans, physically disabled, mentally unstable, murderers, and more. Over 1,700 bodies are buried in unmarked graves, and hundreds more deaths went undocumented. Rolling Hills Asylum is known for a plethora of phenomena, including disembodied voices, doors slamming, footsteps, sounds of furniture moving, full-body apparitions, shadow people, ghostly touches, and numerous Class A EVP. Rolling Hills Asylum proudly offers historical and flashlight tours, 4- and 8-hour public ghost hunts, 8- and 9-hour private ghost hunts, and more, by appointment or pre-booking only. For more information, please visit www.rollinghillsasylum.com. That's www.rollinghillsasylum.com. Or give them a call, 585-502-4066. That's 585-502-4066. Rolling Hills Asylum. What are you doing this weekend?
I'm Victor the Voice Furman, and you're listening to the DTM Wicked Radio Network. And we're back on Love and Romance Radio. Our guest this evening, Susan Shapiro, New York Times bestselling author of 10 books, including 5 Men Who Broke My Heart, Lighting Up, and her latest novel, What's Never Said. Lori Sue?
So I was looking at a picture of myself when I was 19 years old, because a friend of mine turned 60 last week, and I was reminded that at that age, I was having an affair, and it wasn't even an affair. I was dating one of my professors. You could probably relate to this. And I remembered back to that time, he waited until the end of the semester, and then he came up to me and he said, "Can I talk to you?" And he basically said, "You know, I think we're both interested in each other. What I'm trying to say is I'd really like to make love to you. Take a walk with me." And we walked out of the building and we talked about how we might see each other. And this relationship began. And one of the things he said to me is, "I know that you're mature enough to handle this." So, of course, something bad happened between us. We had a bad breakup. And he turned around and said to me, I thought you were more mature than this. And I was just thinking about...
Like, that sounds so much like my book, What's Never Said.
You know, and when I looked at that picture of myself, I realized how young I was. I mean, I was really a baby, and it was my first man. It was my first real guy. So, of course, you know, I think that I carried it with me for a long time because we did have a bad breakup. And then I went back when I was a young reporter and I was trying to complete things. And I sat there and kind of was going over with him over a glass of wine in his apartment. We were just chatting about the things that were really painful to me and the way I felt abandoned. And he said, oh, baby, I wish you had told me about that. I didn't realize that. I would have done something about that. So he had no memory of anything happening. And the reason I'm bringing this up is just about like a month or so ago or recently, I see this little comment on social media from him. He and I emailed like a couple of months ago about something, and he found me on social. No, I think I found him because I was working on a book and I kind of wanted to just see what was happening. And he leaves a message someplace about me saying I'm an honest, decent person. And I was trying to figure out what he was trying to say, and I figured maybe he was sort of making amends. So it brings me to the question I had for you about the way we try to decode what men try to say to us. Because you had that situation with Brad in The Five Men That Broke My Heart, where he sent you a cryptic message, and you had to go on your husband's email to try to figure it out.
Yeah, I do think that in my experience, women are more articulate and men are, especially when it comes to feelings, and it's more difficult to read men, although part of it is I've been in therapy, and interestingly, I with my addiction specialist, I was in therapy with a man, and it was sort of fascinating to be doing intensive addiction therapy with a male who could articulate feelings. It was kind of fascinating, and he actually helped me get married, and he gave me really good advice on relationships. I recommend therapy for a lot of people. Anybody that's having trouble with relationship, couples therapy, addiction therapy, because I do think that it helps people be more articulate. But I also think that in Five Men Who Broke My Heart, one of the things that I learned was you could, it's your job to protect yourself, and it's your job to ask the questions that you need answered. And if someone's incapable of that, you have to walk away and find answers yourself. So I will say that, I would say as much as I tried to blame men, it was really most of the bad relationships I had were my own fault. I would say that it's difficult if you're with, the scenario that you described with the teacher, it's really hard to have an equal relationship with someone who has more power over you.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a teacher, that could be a boss, that could be a mentor. So I do think that that's a problematic relationship, but I also think that you can't just blame the man for that because there's a lot in it there's a lot in it for the woman too. And meaning that we like to feel special, and if teacher likes you or your mentor or your boss or your editor likes you, so there's sort of a hunger, an intense desire that maybe I had as a young woman to be special. And I hadn't worked through my own issues. And by the way, lots of people, because I have a lot of college students, lots of people go to therapy or find a counselor or find somebody that can help you with relationships in high school and college and graduate school. So, there's a part of me, I always say that I'm a raging feminist who loves men and marriage. So I don't really want to just blame men in general because I feel like this happens across the board. And by the way, this happens in gay relationships. It happens in trans relationships. Mm-hmm. I've had, in bisexual relationships. So it's not only... young women who are victimized by older men. I think that a lot of us have unrealistic expectations about relationships, or we're trying to, it's a father figure, a mother figure. There's a hole in our heart from our childhood, and we're trying to fulfill it with, a new love relationship.
Yeah.
And so I do think, and again, I have I think I have like 20,000 former students, and a lot of people are writing about, I always say being a writing teacher is like being a shrink, only we get paid a lot less. But so I will say that there are a lot of ways that you could, you know, if you want to improve your relationships with other people, improve your relationship with yourself and you know, get a little bit more centered and clear on who you are, what do you want, what are your expectations, and, mm-hmm. and if you put yourself in a scenario, and you're never too young. I mean, I know people, at this age, especially in New York or LA, people will go to therapy or find counselors, you know, at age 13, 14, 15, if your parents are getting divorced, if you have drug issues or any kind of alcohol issues. So I would say, you know, my biggest advice for people, in fact, in Secrets of a Fix-Up Fanatic, I think the first chapter is sort of like, fix yourself up first. So if somebody comes to me and say, I want to be fixed up, but then I ask them 10 questions mm-hmm. and they're, you know, an alcoholic, or they're unhappy, or they don't have a place to live, they're living in their parents' basement, or they have a job, you know, one day a week for $22, and they don't have any money, you know, nobody who's a mess is going to get into a relationship that's going to fix them.
Right.
You know, you kind of have to fix yourself first.
Of course.
Yeah, so I would say that even though it seems as if these older men are predators to younger women, there's a lot of younger women who are using men. I mean, Marla Maples comes to mind. There's a lot of younger women who are glomming on to men. I mean, truthfully, I feel sorry for Monica Lewinsky, but I don't blame Clinton 100% for that, because she was, you know, she was young, she was hungry, she wanted mm-hmm. sex, she wanted to be famous, she glommed on to the most powerful man she could in order to elevate herself. And you have to own that too. You know, she's like, oh, I was so young and I was so innocent. Well, you know what? There's a lot of 18, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, 24-year-olds who play by the rules, who don't try to glom on to some rich, famous guy who's already married to somebody else. So I think that your own moral compass, you know, being in therapy or sometimes even a mentor, your favorite teacher, a mentor, somebody older and married, if you can't talk to your parents, maybe there's a relative involved, a shrink, someone at AA. I mean, I think that there's ways for anybody of any age to kind of figure themselves out and figure out what they want and why they're doing things. And I think that that's going to make any relationship that you have better.
Right. Let me backtrack a minute, because I didn't feel like this guy was a predator at all. I mean, he was 34 and I was 19, and I was thrilled that my professor was interested in me, because I thought he was really hot and sexy, and I was young and he was single, I was single. You know, we made a decision. It's just that the reason I mention it, and this is actually the first time I've ever mentioned it, because I promised him I would not, although I have written about it in fiction, is that I believe, I have this theory that one of the reasons we hold on to these memories of these ex-loves, the reason they may mean something to us, is that we didn't, you know, just like, that's why I was so drawn to your books. We don't most of the time get a chance to complete it the way you did and went out and made it a project. Most women either stalk the ex-loves on social media or, you know, ask people in the old neighborhood. And I think we cling on in some ways because we never got to complete it back then. Like, I never really got to have a conversation, even though I sat and had a conversation with this guy about the things that were hurting me, because in his hearing of it at the time, he couldn't really hear it, or he couldn't see it from my point of view. And I don't.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't think it's a bad idea. I mean, again, I think you have to be really, really careful of your motives, and you have to have low expectations. But if there's something from the past that's hurting you or bothering you, or that you think you did wrong, or some confusion, I don't think it's in most cases, I don't think it's horrible to write someone a letter or an email or say, do you have 5 minutes over the phone, or could we discuss this, or could we have a cup of coffee? But again, you got to watch your expectations, because if you're married and the other person is married, and your motive is, you think that your motive is, oh, I just want to find out what happened, but it's really I'm bored with my marriage and I want to sleep with somebody else, that's not going to lead anybody to anything good.
That's a very important distinction, because when, you know, there is a very big difference between reaching out to get a little clarity or completion on something and reaching out because you want to activate something. And I think
right.
Don't
so I think yeah,
you have to be very careful.
And again, it's the reason why having a therapist or being in AA or having a sponsor, having a counselor, just to talk it out and to just make clear what do you want from this. One of the things that my addiction specialist taught me when I was quitting all my addictions, which really helped me, is I asked him, how do I stay clean and sober and happy and successful? And the biggest piece of advice he gave me was lead the least secretive life you can. So I do feel like that has been, if there's any mantra that I have, that's my mantra. And it's really funny because I've written about really raunchy, crazy stuff from my past. And people, especially from, you know, I'm from West Bloomfield, Michigan, you know, very conservative Midwest town. And friends, you know, and family, they come up to me, you know, after I've written all this stuff about, you know, drug addiction and insane relationships and abortions and all this stuff. And they're like, you know, after I wrote them, they were like, oh, my God, what happened to you? Like, you put all this stuff out there and, you know, what happened? How did, you know, how did you deal with it? How did your family deal with that? How did your friends deal with it? And I'm like, let's see, what happened? I made a shitload of money. I got 10 books. I got movie deals. I got great teaching gigs. We expanded my apartment. My marriage is hotter than ever. You know, my family doesn't like any of my books, but I still talk to them every day. They still talk to me. I love them. Hilariously, when I go home, it's like I have to look really carefully in the house to find one of my books. Like I found one like hidden under a bunch of other stuff as if it were like smut, you know, like Penthouse or something like that. But basically only great things have happened in my life, and I've only become stronger and happier by confronting things and by, you know, being more open and being out there. And I'm not saying every single person that would happen to, because certainly there, I'm sure there's family members who get mad at other family members for writing about them, or, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm sure bad things happen when people confront the past. On the other hand, I've seen really great things happen. So like just for an example, my student, her name is Dori Olds, who wrote Facebook Suggested I Befriend My Rapist. She wrote about that, and it got her piece got in the New York Times. And she did confront a few of the people on Facebook. One of them she wrote and said, I see from Facebook you have a daughter my age. I hope you remember that, what you did to me, and that nobody ever does it to your daughter.
Wow.
And she really, like, confronted. And the piece ran in the New York Times. And then I think she was asked to be on television, and she was interviewed on TV. And then someone at John Jay, who teaches criminal law, asked her to come speak to the class. And now they teach her piece every term, and now she's working on a memoir. So I will say that there's a lot of people who confront things that have happened to them in the past, and it's wound up being fantastic. I mean, I even know a woman who wrote about how after her husband died abruptly from a heart attack, she went on his computer and she found out that he had 5 lovers, and she went and met each one. And she actually said it was like this weird inverse of my book, and she wanted me to blurb it. But that book was a New York Times bestseller. You know, and so I'm just saying that sometimes confronting your past or dealing with it in art is a great thing, and it's liberating. You know, so I do think there's you can't just sort of blindly go call people from your past or look up everybody, or you can't like show up at someone's doorstep after 25 years demanding answers. That's insane. But I do think that, you know, if you have a shrink, a sponsor, a counselor, a mentor, and if it's a well thought out decision that something in my life is hurting me, like this relationship from my past kind of is haunting me, and there were things I never understood, and you question, you know, do you think it would be appropriate for me to contact this person? And if it's well thought out, you know, I also think you can't, you know, in 5 Men Who Broke My Heart, when I was re-meeting people, I wasn't sending them like an 8-page letter of longing. You know, it was really like, you know, hey, I'm writing about all the kooky things I did about my past, and I wondered if you ever had 5 minutes, if we could talk on the phone or have a drink. Like, I kept it very light, and you know, and I had really thought about it a lot, and it was measured. So I absolutely, in most cases, I would say to somebody, if you think about it and you have, you know, you get advice from someone smart, if there's something bothering you from your past, not a bad idea to fix it. You know, and what's so exciting with writing is that it is a way to go back and to kind of rewrite the story and rewrite the ending. You know, like just for example, the way that I felt like with my first love, the way that it originally ended, I felt like such a loser for so long. And I really felt like a victim, and that he was this horrible guy, and I was all confused. So writing about it, you know, not only did I feel triumphant to get a book on a Today Show, he loved it. In fact, one of the other guys wrote me a note and said, you've written a better character than I am a person. And I actually found out I had a very crazy story where one of the guy's wives started contacting me, and I wrote about that. It was fascinating. And she said to me, she told me that he ran out to get a copy of the book and to get a review that mentioned his quote, which was kind of exciting to know. The first boyfriend, he did come back, and I wrote about it for the New York Times, and I broke into the New York Times Modern Love column. And so in a way, it was a way to turn this really horrible tragedy into something that I understood and something I control, and maybe even something that helped other people.
Absolutely. Mm. You know, I don't know that I look at my past relationships the same way that other men do. From the eyes of age and experience, I look back and recognize. I also would take the title of serial monogamist on. I had not a lot of relationships, always one at a time, probably 6 real relationships, including my marriage to Lori Sue. But in retrospect, I would say that each of those relationships helped build me and prepare me to be in relationship and marriage with Lori Sue. And without one of those experiences, I don't know that I would have been ready when I met Lori Sue.
Right. And, you know, you learn what you don't want and you learn what you need. On the other hand, I think, you know, because I've talked to a lot of men about this, too, and I feel like if there's something with men, it would be more likely from a lot of men that I know that there was somebody in their past that they dumped or that they weren't nice to, that they felt that they feel guilt, you know, and if that were the case, I don't think it's, I mean, by the way, not everybody needs to confront things in their past, but if there's something bothering you or some karma thing, you know, like in AA, it's like you make amends for things that you did wrong in order to help you move forward. So, you know, I have talked to a lot of men about, is it a good idea for me to contact this person and say, I'm sorry. And if the woman is still single and you're happily married, it's probably not a good idea. But there are cases where I feel like it's, you know, saying to someone, hey, you know, at this stage in my life, I'm looking over things and I wasn't kind to you, or I think I hurt you and I never meant to. So, you know, sometimes I think that's a healing, that could be healing.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Yeah,
no, I mean, it's interesting. I've gotten callbacks from men who feel like I might have been the one to get away over the years. I'm not talking about very recently. And it always seems to me that their connection is, their need is different than my need. If I was making the phone call, mine would be more emotional, and I think theirs might have been possibly more sexual or more a need.
Well, I don't think any two people are ever going to have the same, you know, especially after 20 or 30 years, are ever going to have the same need or emotion attached. It's always going to be different. I'll tell you a funny one I got. So I wrote 5 Men Who Broke My Heart, and I got this email from somebody I didn't even remember. I guess it was someone I knew in high school. And he said, I heard about your book. Hey, am I one of the men? And I said, we never dated. And he said, oh, but I always had a crush on you. And he was really like, why didn't you write about me? And I was like, well, I didn't know that you had a crush on me. And the book is called 5 Men Who Broke My Heart. So if I didn't even know that you had a crush on me, why would I write about you? But it was so hilarious. And he was really like miffed that in his head, I was like a big deal that I didn't write about him. But anyway, so I think everybody is always going to have different motives. And it's going to be based on where you are in your life. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you're very happily married with children and you're fulfilled, you're going to maybe you feel a little bit of guilt or a little bit of nostalgia, but you're not going to have a burning need. On the other hand, if you're 62 years old and single and alone and frustrated and having problems in your life or have no money, and then there's this beautiful, you know, picture of you at your prom where you thought your life was going to be wonderful, there's going to be a more, you know, that person's going to be more desperate. So I do think you have to be, you know, if you want to go back and re-meet an ex, I do think you have to be careful. Although, you know, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, it's a great way to start because you really do get to see, you know, it's sort of fascinating. Within seconds, you could be staring at, you know, somebody's, you know, child's 8th birthday party, and you could just see all the players. And you know, and it does give you a sense of, quite often people do say if they're single or married or divorced or widowed. So I do think Googling somebody is a great way to sort of screen before you decide. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I would never make a decision to just, you never want to spontaneously just show up, you know, and meet an ex. Mm-hmm. I think it always has to be more measured, and you have to ask yourself, what do you want? And doing it with a therapist or a counselor, AA sponsor or close friend, telling your spouse, you know, I think that there's really good reasons to re-meet somebody. And I think that there's really bad reasons where you could get hurt.
Now, with reference to divorced or widowed people, there's an old expression that says men replace women and women grieve. Do you find that to be the truth?
No, I find that truthfully almost every person that I've met who is widowed or divorced of any age wants to re-meet somebody. I do know two women who it did take them a while before they were 100% ready, but I would, almost everyone that I've ever met, male or female, especially interestingly, if you had a good relationship, I think those people are even they want to re-meet somebody faster because they know what love is in their life. I mean, maybe I would say that the women that I know would take a little bit longer before they'd be open to meet somebody, but I don't think I've ever met somebody who says, I'm finished, I don't want to try.
You know, interestingly, in my other job as a wedding officiant, I have married many couples who found each other again after a breakup. Like one of my couples was on a bicycle, the other one was walking around a corner in New York, and they had separated 10 years before after high school, and now they have three kids.
Really common story.
Yeah, and other couples, you know, who knew each other 30 years ago and found each other. So, in other news, you are a matchmaker. I don't know, do we call you an amateur matchmaker?
Yeah, I used to call myself an amateur matchmaker.
And I know you did the book, Secrets of a Fix-Up Fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't this whole thing start when you were matched with your hubby? Was that the genesis of it?
I actually had started fixing up people a long time before, because I had, where we were from in Michigan, I had a really big house. We had like the party house, which had like pinball machines and a pool and a sauna and everything. And I think my parents used to feel like, if you're going to get into trouble, do it here where we could watch you. So we had the party house. So very early on in high school, people met at my house. And there's actually a few couples who met at my house when they were 13, 14, 15 that are married, happily married with kids. And so that's when it started. So I was sort of inadvertently fixing people up because I would have parties and events and stuff like that. So that's when it started. But then, yes, it turned out I was fixed up with my husband. I always joke I was fixed up with my husband and his runner-up, which was the guy who, when my husband couldn't commit, I was fixed up with the guy who wanted to get married, who made my husband jealous enough to come back and propose. But so that exacerbated it, and it also made me feel so much gratitude and so happy that it made me want to fix up people more, because I saw it's really the greatest present you can give someone. On the other hand, several of the couples out of 30 that I hooked up got divorced, and that feels bad, because, you know, then I feel guilty, and sometimes you have to choose between which one you're going to be friends with or not. Mm-hmm. Although I think there's about 25 kids in the world because I fixed them up, so that's sort of cool. Including my brother. I fixed my brother up with a New York friend, and he has four kids.
Wonderful.
So that's a cool feeling.
Very cool. Tell us about the other ways you've brought couples together.
Well, I would say the biggest one, because when I started doing it, it was pre-internet. So I've always just been, I'm from a big family and I'm gregarious, so I've always just had a lot of parties and events. So I think meeting in person is still a really cool way to meet somebody. So I'm constantly having, you know, book events and parties and panels. And, you know, and so I think that getting in somebody's face and you know, having somebody like me, I'm gregarious and I introduce people, I do think that's a great way of meeting someone, because there's so many people who meet online and they have all these like intense, you know, oh my God, what is that line? I love you, let's meet, you know, and then they're so disappointed because they take one look at the person and they didn't know that they were short or fat or bald or, you know, so I do think meeting in person is great. So one of the ways that I've always done it is I've always had a lot of events. I still do. I have big classes and events and stuff like that. So that, to me, that's the easiest way of doing it. Also, sometimes I have a close friend who will tell me their story and ask me to fix them up. And there's certain times where I feel compelled to fix people up. Like, just for example, if somebody, you know, if somebody's read my books or someone tells me their story, and especially if they say, you know, I'm really ready, if you know anybody, wonderful. I really love that story, you know, when somebody says that. And I really hate it if someone comes to me and says, you know, very common story is, you know, a woman who's 43 years old who's never been married and says to me, you know, I really want you to fix me up, and I want someone just like your husband, and he has to have a great job, and he has to have money, and he has to live in this neighborhood, and he has to do, you know, and I sort of feel like, you know, if you would have met my husband when I met him, you wouldn't have gone out with him, because he didn't have any money at the time, and he was sleeping on a torn mattress on the floor, and he had an inability to commit, and, you know, so I hate when people have this, you know, they haven't done the work on themselves.
Right,
they're so superficial.
Right, right. So they want the mate to
grass
be like
is greener.
That.
Right. And, you know, and they're just, and just superficial. Whereas if somebody just says, introduce me to somebody wonderful, and they're more open, then it's much more likely that they're going to have success, I think.
So after all is said and done, despite, you know, some of the challenges with exes and the broken hearts and all of the learning, do you still believe in love?
Oh, yeah. I think that I'm madly in love with my husband. And I actually think that the fact that it took me so long to get here makes me appreciate him so much more. And what's interesting is sometimes, like, I thank God every day that I met him and that we wound up together. And what's so interesting is that, you know, when I was younger, I thought, oh, it was so romantic at 16 or the first love or whatever. And it's what's so cool is that to be middle age and to feel like this is more exciting than anything that I ever had, because this is, you know, it's real and it's, you know, and it's long lasting. So I absolutely do believe in love. But again, I also believe that, you know, love doesn't make you happy, make yourself happy. And I do think that, you know, in order to have a good relationship and be in a good relationship, you have to do work on yourself. And you have to, you know, and it's interesting because a lot of people say, you know, you shouldn't have to change for the other person. Totally disagree. My husband and I have changed every single thing about from our diets. He said, quit smoking, quit drinking, rearrange your furniture, throw this out. We have completely remade each other. So I think that, you know, I think that being open and being willing to compromise is essential.
But it's really about remaking yourself for yourself in the end. The partner helps you do it, but it's really about doing it for you.
You know, truthfully, I did not want to quit smoking or drinking. I did not want to. And my husband basically said, I'm going to leave you. And we had just put every cent we ever had into an apartment.
Wow.
And I just had two huge weddings with 600 people. So I was like, oh, my God. And he sort of put me in a corner. So I do think, I mean, I think this is part of the reason why happily married couples live longer, you know, is I do think that sometimes you have to compromise things in yourself that you're not ready to, you know, and you do have to accommodate another human being. You know, so I like I said, when people say, you know, I have to be myself, I'm like, well, you could be really right and really yourself and really alone, or you could learn to compromise and be with another person. So I feel like, you know, I have a, you know, based on my own experience, my attitude is that, you know, being happy with somebody takes a lot of work on both ends, but it's absolutely worth it.
Absolutely.
So we're wrapping up here. Let's just ask, what's next for you in teaching and writing books? Anything we should know about?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a new memoir called The Forgiveness Tour, Seeking the Perfect Apology. And
wow.
Maybe it sort of fits in with the, you know, Five Men Who Broke My Heart and Lighting Up, because I had a big falling out with somebody in my life. And I realized that I'm the type of person who, I could forgive anybody anything if they come to me and say, I am sorry because I did this, but I can't forgive somebody if they don't know it. So it's sort of an exploration of that.
I remember reading an article of yours about breaking up with a friend.
Yeah, my best friend broke my heart.
Aww.
But she loved the piece. I got a great piece out of it, and she loved the piece. And I do. I see her when she's in New York or in L.A. She just, that piece was really about how she got married, moved away, had two kids very late, and just was unable to continue the kind of relationship that we used to have when we were single. But that piece was basically about, I'm giving her all the space that she needs. We didn't break up. I'm giving her all the space that she needs and letting her control the shots. So when she wants me here, I'm there. And when she doesn't, I'll walk, you know, I'll give her space.
Fascinating, honest, insightful, and funny. Susan Shapiro, author of Five Men Who Broke My Heart, Lighting Up, and her latest, What's Never Said. Susan, please tell our listeners where they can get your books and find out more about you.
SusanShapiro.net is my website, and you can follow me at SusanShapiroNet on Twitter.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
This has been great.
Wonderful.
Been
really fun.
That was
and
so
I'm
much
Victor
fun.
The Voice Furman.
And I'm Lori Sue Brockway, the Romance Reverend.
And we are Love and Romance Radio.
Radio.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Thanks,
see you next
everyone.
Week.